Behind the Line, episode number 53. I'm your host, KC. You can follow me on Twitter at KC_BTL84. Hit that like and subscribe button. Make sure to click that notification bell to receive all updates from the channel. I appreciate your support. If you paid your $70, $80, $100, whatever the price was, for the Deontay Wilder-Tyson Fury heavyweight championship fight Saturday night, you were either highly entertained or highly disappointed. I've been following the fight game since I was a teenager, 20 years ago. I wouldn't call myself an expert. I don't know MMA or UFC like Joe Rogan. I don't know boxing like Max Kellerman. I don't know boxing or UFC like I know the NFL and the NBA. I just watch the big fights, the marquee fights. I've seen hundreds, maybe thousands of fights in my lifetime. Some were memorable. Some were classics. Some were downright boring. Mayweather-Pacquiao back in 2015, one of the most hyped fights ever, ended up being a colossal disappointment. A lot of Floyd Mayweather fights are boring. But Floyd Mayweather-Conor McGregor, on the other hand, was highly entertaining the whole time. You never know what you're going to get when you pay your money to watch a big-time fight. It could be over in 45 seconds. It could go the distance. Of all the fights I've watched, I've never seen a more lopsided fight than what I witnessed Saturday night. Deontay Wilder looked like he didn't belong in the same ring as Tyson Fury. It was complete domination for 7 rounds. I don't remember Deontay Wilder even landing any impact punches. Think he might have landed a couple maybe in the first or the second round, but that was about it. Tyson Fury was in his face the entire fight. He did exactly what he said he was going to do. All week leading up to the fight, he told the world that he was going to be aggressive. He wasn't going to leave it up to the judges this time around. He was going to knock Deontay Wilder's ass out. And he delivered. The fight ended kind of anticlimactically, in my opinion. Deontay Wilder's corner threw in the towel in the middle of the 7th round. To be honest, they could have thrown in the towel in the 5th or the 6th round. Fury landed a shot to Wilder's ear early on in the fight, and I don't know if he was concussed. I don't know if it threw off his equilibrium. Whatever happened, he was finished after that shot. Tyson Fury knocked him down a couple of times, but Deontay Wilder fell on his own several times. He could never find his balance after getting hit in the ear. He was off balance, looked like the most unathletic boxer that I'd ever seen. It's being reported that Deontay Wilder has 30 days to demand a rematch. It's in the contract that they could have a third fight in this series. After what I saw Saturday night, I have zero interest in seeing these two guys fight again. To be honest, I don't know if Deontay Wilder can come back from this. I don't think he'll ever be the same. If he were in this fight, if he had made it at least somewhat competitive, if he had landed a couple of fucking shots on Tyson Fury, then maybe a rematch would be compelling. Maybe I would be interested in seeing these two guys fight for a third time. Maybe Deontay Wilder could bounce back from defeat. But this wasn't defeat. This was a mauling by Tyson Fury. Like I said earlier, it was 7 rounds of complete domination. I don't think Deontay Wilder can come back from it. We've seen this before in boxing. Big name fighter gets his ass kicked. He's never the same. It happened to Mike Tyson. Mike Tyson was the most feared boxer in the sport. The motherfucker was knocking people out in seconds. Most of his fights ended in the first or the second round. Then 1990 rolls around. He schedules a warm-up fight with Buster Douglas to prep him for the real fight that everyone wanted to see between him and Evander Holyfield. They had to take the fight all the way to Japan because America didn't want it. It was the most lopsided fight in history in terms of betting odds. Tyson was a huge favorite. The odds were 42-1. And the only sports book in the country that would even take a fucking bet on the fight. Of course, we all know what happened. Buster Douglas shocks the world, beats Mike Tyson. And Mike Tyson was never the same after that loss. After that defeat, he never won another big-time major fight. He beat some scrubs leading up to his fight with Evander Holyfield, a fight that was pushed back to 1996 because Mike Tyson was in prison. Then he loses two straight fights to Holyfield in convincing fashion. Hell, he had to bite his fucking ear off in the second fight because he was getting his ass kicked so bad. But after losing to Buster Douglas, Mike Tyson was 13-5-2 the remainder of his career. He was never the same fighter. The mystique around him, the intimidation was gone. He had one major fight after the Evander Holyfield fight the second time. It was against Lennox Lewis in 2002. He got his ass knocked out. Only time will tell if Deontay Wilder will be able to overcome this type of devastating loss to Tyson Fury. But I just don't see it happening. All right, switching gears. One of the NBA's oldest rivalries was in full force Sunday afternoon. The Boston Celtics traveled to Los Angeles, took on the Lakers in Staples Center. It was a great game. Playoff-like atmosphere in Los Angeles. Even though the Lakers won, this game to me was indicative of the problems that LeBron James and the Lakers are going to face in the playoffs. First off, when the Celtics were at full strength, they beat the Lakers by 32 points just a month ago. So LeBron James and the Lakers squeaking out a win at home against a Celtics team playing without Kemba Walker is hardly what I would call impressive. They should have won this game by 8-10 points. Should have never been in a situation where it comes down to a last-second miss by Jason Tatum. The end of the game, though, the last 2 minutes, are going to be a problem for the Lakers going forward. It's the same thing I've been saying all year. When the game is on the line, who is taking the clutch shot? Who is the closer on this Lakers team? The answer is they don't have one. But KC, LeBron made the game-winning shot. He is the closer. You can believe that if you want. But the fact of the matter is, LeBron James struggles in late-game situations. Kobe Bryant was a closer. Michael Jordan was a closer. Kawhi Leonard is a closer. Steph Curry, Kevin Durant, Dame Lillard. These guys, with the game on the line, can hit the game-winning shot in the field, or they can go to the free throw line and do it. For as great as LeBron James is, he's never been the guy to want the ball in his hands with the game on the line. Has he made some last-second game-winning shots? Of course. 17, 18 years in the league, you're bound to make some here and there. He's even made some in the playoffs. But the one knack on LeBron's Hall of Fame career is his perceived weakness late in games. And when I say late in games, I mean the final seconds. He'll pass the ball off instead of driving the lane to get to the free throw line with 20 seconds or less on the clock. Why is that? Because he struggles at the free throw line and he knows it. I'm not knocking him. I mean, he knows it's a weakness, so he lets someone else take over. The problem is, he doesn't have that someone else on this roster. Sunday's game against the Celtics was the perfect example of what you can expect to see from the Lakers in close games in the playoffs. They've got two guys in LeBron and Anthony Davis that tend to fade away late in games. Under 2 minutes to play, the Lakers had a three-point lead that was cut to one after Gordon Hayward made a jump shot. Anthony Davis, who had 30 points up to this point in the game, misses an easy layup 2 feet away from the basket. Jaylen Brown for the Celtics knocks down a clutch three at the other end of the floor, puts the Celtics up 2 points. What happens next? Out of a fucking timeout, Anthony Davis misses another easy layup at the fucking rim. Two opportunities in the clutch. Anthony Davis is 0 for 2. 37 seconds to go. Lakers down 2 points. LeBron James at the free throw line, where he has struggled throughout his career, especially late in games. LeBron James makes 1 of 2. Lakers end up getting the rebound, and LeBron does make the clutch jumper that gives them a 1-point lead. Brad Stevens ends up drawing a technical foul, sends Anthony Davis to the free throw line, a guy who's hitting 85% of his free throws on the season. What does AD do? He misses the fucking free throw. He's now 0 for 3 in the clutch. 6 seconds left. Anthony Davis has the chance once again at the free throw line to put the Lakers up 3 points and misses another free throw. If the Lakers had lost this game, and if Kemba Walker had played, they likely would have. The two missed free throws by Anthony Davis would be all we're talking about. What you do in the regular season translates to what you'll do in the playoffs. LeBron James is one of the best players to ever play in the NBA. But when you're in a one-possession game with seconds left on the clock, he needs Anthony Davis to step up. LeBron isn't the guy that can make the free throws. He needs AD to be what Kyrie was in Cleveland or what D-Wade was in Miami, that safety blanket. My point is, with the game on the line, under 10 seconds to go, who on this Lakers roster is comfortable with the ball in their hands with the potential to make the game-winning free throws or make the game-winning play? The Clippers have 3 guys, Kawhi Leonard, Paul George, Lou Williams, Denver, Jamal Murray, Boston, Kemba Walker, Jason Tatum. With the Lakers, it's supposed to be Anthony Davis. That's why they brought him in. But he just isn't that guy. It's not in his DNA. I've been saying it all year. And I think it's going to end up biting the Lakers in the ass in the playoffs. All right, moving on. There are rumors going around that the Green Bay Packers are looking to draft Aaron Rodgers' successor in this upcoming draft. Green Bay's general manager was asked if he would be interested in drafting a quarterback with their first round pick, which is the 30th pick in the first round. And he confirmed their interest in doing so. It's kind of weird sometimes how history tends to repeat itself. Back in 2005, when Brett Favre was 35, 36 years old, the Packers drafted Aaron Rodgers with the 24th pick in the first round. And the move didn't set well with Brett Favre. He never really warmed up to Aaron Rodgers. 3 years later, Favre's playing with the Jets. Aaron Rodgers becomes the man in Green Bay. Now, 12, 13 years later, it's entirely possible that Aaron Rodgers, at 36 years old, will now get to know how Brett Favre felt. It wouldn't surprise me if Rodgers treated a new young quarterback coming in exactly the way that Brett Favre treated him, possibly worse. Actually, I would be surprised if it didn't go down like that. But the question is, should the Packers be looking to draft Aaron Rodgers' successor right now? And the answer is no. I understand this draft class is deep with quarterbacks. This is the best draft class in years in terms of the number of potentially good NFL quarterbacks that it has in it. Projections are predicting that 5 quarterbacks could go in the first round alone. I keep seeing people say that Aaron Rodgers is on the decline. Fucking really? The guy just carried the Packers to 13-3 in an NFC championship game. He threw 26 touchdowns to just 4 interceptions. The problem in Green Bay isn't Aaron Rodgers. It's Aaron Rodgers' contract. It severely limits Green Bay's ability to get him any help. I actually saw a report in The Athletic today that suggested the Packers draft Rodgers' successor this year, then look into trading for Josh Rosen. Are you fucking kidding me? I laughed out loud when I read that. Josh Rosen? The guy not even the Arizona fucking Cardinals wanted? The guy that the Miami Dolphins don't want? What Green Bay needs to do is what New Orleans and New England have done with Drew Brees and Tom Brady as they've gotten older. You go to Aaron Rodgers and you ask him to restructure his contract for less money or shift some of that money to hit your cap in later years. And you go out and you get him some help. Of course, Aaron Rodgers got to be willing to do that. But at this point, he's made his money. So he can either continue to pad his bank account and the Packers won't be legitimate Super Bowl contenders, or he can take a hometown discount and allow the team to get some talent around him and add to his legacy. It's one of the two. If you're going to draft Rodgers' successor in this year's draft, then you're going to have to let him go. And Green Bay's going to have a difficult time doing that with 4 years left on his contract. I don't see Aaron Rodgers as the type of guy who's going to be willing to teach and groom his potential replacement. It's going to be one contentious locker room if you have Aaron Rodgers and his successor in the same locker room. I'm not against preparing for the future or drafting Aaron Rodgers' replacement, but I don't think right now is the time to do it. 2 years from now, go for it. But not now when you're coming off the best season in Green Bay since 2011 and Aaron Rodgers is the main reason you got there. All right, before I get out of here, I wanted to touch on one thing real quick. If you've been listening to this podcast for a while, then you've probably heard me talk about how much I like Mark Cuban. Mark Cuban is one of my favorite owners in sports, and Saturday night is exactly why I like him so much. The Dallas Mavericks were the latest victims of shitty officiating. There was a highly controversial call or non-call or it was a whistle or it was an inadvertent whistle. No one really fucking knows what was going on. The only thing we do know is it cost Dallas in their game against Atlanta. The officials called goaltending on a Trae Young shot that was blocked by Dallas. It was a clear block. There was no question about it. But while the play was stopped because of the whistle, John Collins with the Hawks grabbed the rebound and made the putback shot. The officials reviewed the play, determined it wasn't goaltending, but said there was an inadvertent whistle, so the putback by John Collins counted. What? If it wasn't goaltending, then what are you reviewing? Even if the whistle were inadvertent, wouldn't the entire play stop after that point? The explanation made no fucking sense whatsoever. Anyway, Mark Cuban took to Twitter and just completely blasted NBA officials. And rightfully so. I don't think that we see owners in professional sports do this enough. There's a real officiating problem in the NFL and the NBA right now. And I don't think the owners speak up enough about it. So the problem never really gets addressed. If more owners stepped up and spoke out like Mark Cuban, maybe something would be done about the problem. The players can't do it. Management can't do it. But the owners can. What the fuck can Adam Silver and Roger Goodell do to team owners who speak out about shitty officiating? What are they going to do? Fine them? They're fucking billionaires. Who the fuck cares? The fact of the matter is, there's too much technology available for us to continue to have incompetency when it comes to officiating these games in professional sports. So credit to Mark Cuban for speaking out and speaking the truth. All right, that's all for today. I'll be back either Thursday or Friday morning. Hit that like and subscribe button. Make sure to click the notification bell to receive all notifications from the channel. Leave a comment in the section below. Let me know what you think of the podcast. I appreciate your support, and I'll see you guys later this week.